Titus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
An obscure body in the SK system, Your Majesty. The inhabitants refer to it as the planet Earth. Will you destroy this Earth?
Later. I like to play with things a while. Before annihilation.
Welcome to Host Choice, where we hosts finally get to choose what we watch. While discussing Star Wars, I was shocked to discover that my co-host had never seen the 1980 film Flash Gordon, so here we are. I'm your host, quarterback, New York Jets.
Pull the other one.
My co-host is Guy, who claims he accidentally watched Flash Gordon for this episode.
I did actually watch the trailer for it just earlier this evening, just out of curiosity.
Looks
like it could be fun in its own right.
One of the downsides of kind of online porn is that we sort of lost, you know, like every major film and all that, right, had the porn version of it. And we just don't have that these days. we talked about it a bit before. We talked about this during the last, you know, the Hidden Fortress and the Star Wars episode, where originally George Lucas wanted to do Flash Gordon, but he couldn't get the rights, and he ended up doing Star Wars. And so,
I think it was Federico Fellini at the time who had the rights to it.
In fact, if you notice there was a character they mentioned very briefly just walking through, they call Fellini
when the princess is leading him around on a leash.
Oh my God, all the BDSM stuff in this. And so in a way, this is the alternate universe where, you know, George Lucas got to make Flash Gordon instead.
Although I suspect he would have had a very different touch with it if he had done it. But who knows?
So before watching this, what was your familiarity with the movie?
I'd heard of it. Of course, I've heard the Queen theme song many times because I've got the Greatest Hits CD and all that. But really, I knew very little about it. I didn't even know what a terrific cast it is.
Oh, my God, yeah.
So, most of this was a complete surprise to me. And at first, a little bit of an unpleasant surprise because I was expecting more of a Star Wars type of more serious tone, and that's not what this movie is at all. And it took me a little bit to sort of get in the spirit of things.
Yeah, it's a very campy movie. Now, I might have even said this previously on the podcast, and I was wrong. I thought I had read that Dino De Laurentiis, who produced it, and he also produced the 1976 King Kong, which we actually liked pretty well.
Yeah.
And he also did the original Dune. So, I mean, he's done all these things, and there's always something sort of flawed about them, you know, although I think this is, of those, I think this is probably maybe the best one.
What, now, he was involved in the David Lynch Dune?
Yeah, he produced that, yeah.
Okay, all right.
I mean, basically, he was a rich guy who wanted to make movies, you know, and so he just sort of stumbled into it. And I think that he may have been overly criticized because, like I said, we liked the King Kong. You know, it's certainly better than the Peter Jackson King Kongs that go on and on about. And Dune was at least ambitious, right? And choosing David Lynch was just a bizarre but very experimental choice to do with that. I really
enjoy the David Lynch Dune, although there are issues I could, you know, there are things I could argue with about it, but I like it very much, actually.
Yeah, maybe I'll do a comparison sometime. I haven't seen it since I was a teenager.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not as big a fan of, now I haven't seen the second Dune movie, but the recent first one, you know, there's a lot of good things about it, but I wasn't as much a fan as everyone else. It'd be interesting to go back and contrast, although I'm not sure how much I could deal with Sting in a, you know, in a...
Well, you know, he was in good physical shape, so, you know, he did good.
So, in fact, you know, talking about the tone of this, so, well, I say, I was wrong, I thought De Laurentiis thought he was making a serious movie, and everybody else knew that they weren't making a serious movie, but I was just reading up on this, and that's actually not true. He was pushing to make it comedy, and the director... didn't want that. And in fact, even though I think the director did a really good job with it for, you know, what he was doing, the director sort of, you know, regrets the whole thing. He feels like the comedy got away from him and kind of took over the movie.
Yeah. Well, it's not a laugh-a-minute movie. I mean, there are some funny lines in it, but they're not, it's not a laugh-a-minute type of movie, you know, but there's some cute jokes in it.
Well, so let's talk about starting out with the opening song and montage. And I have listened to the soundtrack over and over again, you know, probably hundreds of times. And the opening montage here, which I'd sort of forgotten about, is there's none of the people in the movie or anything. It's the Queen song, and it's like, you know, images from the comics and stuff. So it's very much you know, homage to where this character came from.
Yeah, and probably they're probably trying to establish up front, look, this is not Star Wars, because Star Wars was just 3 years before.
And probably they made this, probably they could make this film because of Star Wars, right? Just like Buck Rogers that I was going to mention. No, I looked at the timing, and I don't know if one of these influenced the other, because they pretty much came out at the same time, but Buck Rogers is very similar to this, right, in terms of the really sexy women and kind of over the top, you know.
Yeah, the TV show Buck Rogers, and which I watched pretty regularly when I was when it was actually on the air. Yeah, there was a certain amount of titillation, and you know, the '70s, late '70s, early '80s in general, there was a lot of TNA on the tube at that time.
What is it, back when television was more civilized. I forget if we talked about it on the podcast or just in person, but it's worth reiterating. We didn't crack me up because I got the whole Buck Rogers series, right? And I put the first season or something on my server, and I was watching. And one of the things on there that I had forgotten about was they actually made the pilot into a movie and released it in movie theaters to kind of promote the series, right? And I sent this to you.
Yeah, the theme with the lyrics, which adds a whole new dimension.
Well,
to
not only that, but they have this idea, because they wanted the movie to be even more sexy, right? They introduced this idea that, well, he's frozen and floating around in space, he's fantasizing, and then they show you all these crotch shots and stuff of the guys. I mean, it's really...
Yeah, it's very, very sensual opening to a movie, one of the more sensual ones.
Yeah, it's just humorous, like, yeah, he's fantasizing, okay, let's show you this. And they're crawling around on a large lit up Buck Rogers, you know, lighting under them, you know, the
yeah, like a stripper platform kind of thing.
But I will say, and I would love for us to cover at least, you know, an episode or two of that sometime, because when I watched like the first episode or something, and I remember so well, you know, the little robot, and which, you know, was very R2-D2, except he actually could talk, and he would carry, and I thought it was a great concept. You know, he carried the other robot around his neck, like,
right. It was like Flava Flav and his clock.
Yeah, you know? The clock. Yeah. But, you know, I really enjoyed it. I thought it worked well. And there is a lot of similarity between that and Flash Gordon. Anyway, so then we go from this opening montage, and, you know, we have Max von Sydow. We don't see him up front. We just see like his hands and stuff being evil, and we hear his voice. But you know, I love this concept where his assistant will just find some random planet And then he has these buttons, you know, we have no idea how this works, but he has these, you know, Max von Sydow has these buttons he can push that'll do like earthquake or, you know, hail or thunderstorm or whatever. And then the whole planet gets...
And hot hail.
Yeah, that was a funny one. And so they choose Earth, you know, this out-of-the-way planet, and he wants to...
Yeah.
He doesn't want to destroy it yet because he likes to play with things first.
Yeah. And he does actually give more explanation on that later on. He says every 1,000 years he checks out a planet and just sort of beleaguers it with various catastrophes that could be natural. And if the residents of the planet realize that it's not natural catastrophes, that's how he knows that it's time to destroy it.
And, of course, that's what happens here because there's a wacko professor who's had this theory that Earth's going to be under attack. You know, for some reason, he basically had a theory that Max von Sydow was going to attack the planet. And, you know, once the planet's under attack, he understands what's happening. And I've been right all these years.
Yeah, he probably, like, looked at, you know, levels of soil samples from the year 980 or something, and, you know, all the
although,
rest
I mean, because it's hard to know how he could predict this, so I feel like he's one of those guys who, you know, they say predicted, you know, 12 of the last 10, you know, depressions or whatever, right? So, yeah. But he has an assistant, and he wants the assistant to come with him, and the assistant's like, screw you. But he actually pulls out.
Yeah, he does not want to fly up in that untested space rocket. Yeah, understandable.
And, you know, yeah, the professor actually pulls a gun on him, but he runs off. And then, you know, our heroes, Flash and Dale Arden, who have just met each other, and they're on a plane, and the plane gets forced down, and, you know, they encounter the professor, and he forces them into the spaceship. Now,
yeah.
Did you notice? So he tricks them to come on board, and then they have a fight, and as part of the fight, they accidentally take off. And this is the pilot episode of Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Yep. Pretty much the same deal, yeah. I didn't make that connection, but you're right. And I just want to say how they get to this doctor's lab is they're on a plane and it's being beleaguered by this hot hail. And so the plane goes down. Flash has been taking flying lessons, so he's able to somewhat control the landing.
Although he hadn't gotten to landing in his lessons yet.
Yeah, but he can at least basically, you know, steer the plane. And so he brings it down gently enough that they don't die. And he brings it down right into a laboratory. And I thought, oh, okay, so they were coming to see this scientist. No, they just happened to crash land into the one building on the planet Earth where they could continue this adventure and save the world. So right there, I was like, you know, if this is what the whole movie is going to be like. But that was before I kind of accepted that this is a comic book movie. It's meant to be over the top and not just over the top like the modern day Marvel movies, but campy over the top.
Right. You know?
So once it took me a little while to get to grips with that, but once I did, I warmed up to it considerably more.
See what you think. I think the point where you kind of decide if you're going with this or not, right, is so they take off in this spaceship. And somehow the spaceship manages to get to presumably an entire other solar system somewhere, you know.
Yeah, there's a big vortex in space.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it kind of goes through that. Yeah, like a wormhole or something. So it kind of makes it make a little more sense. But the part where I feel like you just go with it or you don't is after they've been introduced to Ming and, you know, what's going on, you know, the Emperor and everything, there's what's supposed to be a fight, but it turns into a football game. Right?
yeah.
And, you know, Dale is doing cheerleader stuff and Flash Gordon is running around with these balls, you know, hitting people and knocking people over. And that's where I say, like, okay, the movie's saying this is what this is, you know. So you're just going to, you know, I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And And really, you know, the whole first half of the movie, it was sort of a process of coming to accept it because it was just different from what I had expected. So I watched half of it one day and, you know, said I'll watch the rest tomorrow night. And as soon as I picked it up the next night, I was just like completely in the groove with it. And from then on, it was smooth sailing, you know, so... But it is, if you're not expecting it, it can be, you may have some instinctive resistance to it at first, at least I did.
But one of the things that's really interesting to me to think about with a movie like this is it really is just like 20 degrees, say, from a Star Wars, because you have the same kind of, you know, out there costuming. Mm-hmm. You have the same characters in terms of the kind of military kind of people or this or that, you know. Most of these characters you could plop directly into Star Wars and they fit right into there. It's yeah. just that there's a little bit, you know, they're taking a more comedic approach, but that's why I say, yeah. especially mm-hmm. knowing that the original cut of Star Wars was really bad and had a lot of really bad acting and all this before they cut all that out. I think that, you know, it's really interesting to think about what, you know, when you're making a movie, what's the difference between this one and that one, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the production design is good in this, but it's much more garish than yep. Star Wars is. You know, the costumes, the sets, everything is, it's just, there's a lot of red and gold in it. Yeah, it's just a different style.
And there's a lot of BDSM like this. The guys in the red costumes, which also is like modern Star Wars, right? They had red costume guys, but their helmet, their heads are just completely a BDSM thing, right?
Yeah, like well, they look kind of like gas masks, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And then, and then you know, on top of that, you have a point where the daughter who's... I guess essentially the queen, even though she's the daughter of the emperor, you know, she sort of becomes a traitor and she's getting whipped on her back and it's just, and they have all these marks.
Yeah. In this very tight spandex suit with her butt sticking up off the table.
And the woman who's whipping her is in a tight black thing. It's just like,
Yeah. You know, it's a good, it's a fun scene.
So getting back to Max von Sydow, so I mean, I just think, and apparently he wasn't quite sure how to play it right up until they started filming, but I just feel like he nailed it. I mean, he's such a good, you know, evil emperor.
He is. Well, he's had, I mean, just, he's played Jesus, he's played the devil, he's played an exorcist, he's played Emperor Ming, and that's just, you know, he's played dozens and dozens of things besides that. So he's had a fun career. Well, he's deceased now, unfortunately, but he certainly accumulated a whole lot of fun roles under his belt in the time
he had. Yeah, it was pretty amazing. Well, you know, like English wasn't his first language and stuff, although you wouldn't know it from this film. Yeah, and he was also, you know, like his career started, as you say, I don't know if he was the devil in that one, but it was with the Swedish director...
Ingmar Bergman,
yeah, you know, the one that had the devil and everything in it. Yeah, he was.
I don't think I've seen that one.
Seventh Seal.
I've heard of it.
That was probably the first. I think that was the breakout film for Ingmar Bergman. That would be worth watching sometimes. It's about, you know, death is playing chess with some guy, and there's, you know, it's an interesting one.
He's in a movie that I think we are going to do pretty soon in the future, Needful Things, and his role in that may be, if not my favorite movie villain, at least he's in the high ranks in that movie, so he's just fun.
Okay, that'll be new to me.
And he has such a great voice. I love his voice, and it comes through... In the Emperor Ming role, once in a while, you get a little dose of it.
Yeah. And he has a minion who has a great voice. I should have looked up his...
Clytus?
Yeah, the character's name is Clytus. I'm not sure the actor's name. And that's all you get is the voice because his face is completely covered.
Okay, I remember thinking he had a pretty good voice.
And he has an interesting ending in all this.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, boy.
And so, you know, you basically just have these different regions. Oh, I love one of the introductory scenes, which is also on the soundtrack. So, you know, different regions or, I guess, planets, you know, but each in classic science fiction style, right? A planet is like a jungle planet or a whatever. It's so each planet is sort of one thing.
Planet, yeah. So forth, yeah.
So each planet, you know, the leaders are coming and giving gifts to Ming, as you do. And one leader comes and says, well, because you blasted our planet, we don't have anything to give you except for our loyalty. And the minion's like, well, we greatly value, you know, loyalty overall. And how great is your loyalty to the emperor? And I think Max von Sydow asks him that, and he says, oh, without measure. And Max von Sydow says, we are delighted. Fall on your sword. And then the guy, you know, does a fake out and tries to kill Ming, but there's a floating robot that vaporizes him before he can.
So Ming establishes himself from the start as a pretty ruthless guy. You had a couple other actors listed in the notes that we didn't touch on, and I think we should, because they're pretty cool. This Brian Blessed, I remember him vividly from the first season of Blackadder. And I actually looked it up today, and that first season was 1983. So it was just 3 years after this movie. And I have to think that when they were doing the casting for Blackadder, they just watched this movie and said, oh, we need the bird guy, because he plays the exact same role in the 1983 Blackadder. You know, just this very boisterous, bombastic guy who's you know, in the middle of battle, he's just laughing his head off, you know, just enjoying the hell out of it. So very, very enjoyable character, both in that and in this.
He was also in I, Claudius, which is...
Oh, okay. I actually watched that, but it was probably well over a decade ago that I watched it, and I remember I liked it, but I don't remember a whole lot about it.
He's always this boisterous guy, but particularly in this movie, I mean, he knew what kind of movie he was in, and he is just, you know, going as far over the top as he can with his role. I think it's great. And apparently, I read something on Wikipedia or whatever, it said his line that says, you know, Gordon is alive? apparently, that's like the most quoted line from his career and from the movie and everything. So.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. And then, before I watched the movie, I saw a cast list, and I saw the name Richard O'Brien in it. And it rang a bell, and I was like, that can't be the same, you know, guy I'm thinking of. And it is. It's Riff Raff from the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And he doesn't have a big role. He's a bald guy who's like the assistant to the Robin Hood style prince, the prince who dresses like Robin Hood, basically.
Well, that's and that, by the way, is Timothy Dalton, who got like one movie as James Bond. He's a really good actor. He's one of those guys who's sort of like, he was supposed to be big and he just never quite made it, right? Like, his, you know, he didn't continue as James Bond, etc. And if you haven't seen this, we must watch it. One of my favorite comedy movies is Hot Fuzz.
Oh, I think I did. That's one of that, what is the Cornetto trilogy?
Yeah.
I think we did watch that when you came to visit one time.
That's quite possible.
I think we both were drinking vodka, so I don't remember a whole lot about it.
Both those things are true. I would drag you to the couch and I'd be drinking vodka. Well, he was the bad guy in Hot Fuzz, and it was hilarious. If you remember that, at the end of the movie, there's this little model city, you know, literally where, you know, all the buildings are like 2 feet high or five or whatever. And he falls onto the church and the spire goes through his mouth.
That rings a bell.
Yeah. As they're having this fight through the model city. Anyway, he's, you know, and he is a really good actor who just, you know, never was quite as big as he should have been, but he does a good job in this. And he's kind of the Robin Hood character. His people are the Well, I guess it's kind of a jungle planet, and, you know, they...
Kind of like Dagobah.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a lot of similarities to that. And he starts out kind of bad. I mean, he's the boyfriend of the princess, and he doesn't like Flash, and he tries to kill him.
And, yeah, he's one boyfriend of the princess. You get yeah. the impression she might have a few of them.
There's one point where this sort of dorky surgeon who the princess gets to revive Flash Gordon after he's theoretically been killed. And clearly she uses him or something because he thinks he's in a relationship with her and is all about like, oh, when we get together again or whatever. But it's clear that, you know, he's just, she's just using him.
Yeah.
So going back to that football scene, one of the things I love, and again, it's in the soundtrack, so I know these lines, is that as Flash Gordon is running around, you know, hitting people with these balls and sort of playing football with them and everything, Max von Sydow is asking, you know, his minion, he's like, what's going on? Or, you know, are these men on the right pills? You know, should you execute their trainer? it's really funny. But basically, I mean, I don't know, you know... So you have these different regions and they're all being terrorized and, you know, Flash is sort of the, you know, the flashpoint, right, where everyone can start to resist and...
The revolution kind of crystallizes around it.
Right, and he brings everyone together and they attack. And what I like about the, you know, you mentioned the garish colors, where I think that kind of works is that they have this very colorful space background and it's not just painted like the... You know, things are moving like clouds and stuff in it. And, you know, and everyone's flying through clouds and flying against this brightly colored background and everything. And I think that looks pretty compelling and interesting. And in part, it's helpful they don't try to be realistic with it.
It's pretty neat, but it took me a while, as I said, it took me a while to warm up to it, not just the story itself, but like the production design as well. But once you accept it, you know, it's like I came to love Big Brother.
So, you know, they have a part, as we get toward the end of the movie, one of the things they do, which I guess was really hard to film and caused them a lot of problems, is they have this big rotating platform in the center of the room with spikes on it. Now, these are like rubber spikes, obviously, and if you watch carefully, you can see the spikes being bent when people get on them. But and it really is a rotating platform, so you can just imagine they're fighting on it and jumping on it and jumping off of it. So, you know, it'd be a complete
rotating and tilting.
Yeah,
so it's a double whammy.
And the minion guy dies here in a kind of humorous way, right, where he gets slammed down on the spikes. And then, you know, I think he sort of, maybe like someone else, he sort of collapses and turns into goo or something. You know, it seems
You get a shot of his face where his eyes are just bugging out of the sockets. But it's so comically overdone that it's not super disturbing. Like, right. I mean, that could have been done in a really horrifying way that would give you nightmares almost. But the way this is done, it's more just silly. But it's also fun. You know, I mean, it is kind of like you see it and your first reaction is, oh, and then you're like, oh, OK, you know, it's just a movie.
One of the things I liked about the ending is, so, Flash is in a spaceship, which is totally out of the TV series, right? It's got this big, it's gray and kind of rounded on the end, and it has a big spike sticking out of it, right? And so he crashes the spaceship into where Max von Sydow is having a marriage ceremony with Dale, which also is pretty funny because the priest or whoever who's officiating it, he's like, do you take her as your, you know, the woman of the hour? And he's like, well, the hour, yes, you know. and he says something like, and you'll be loyal, or I don't remember exactly what he says, something like, you'll be loyal to her for you know, and Max von Sydow looks at him, you know, upset, and he's like, until you decide to toss her aside, of course.
I don't remember the exact line. It's something like that, or until you grow weary of her, or something like that. And It's pretty amusing.
But I think because I think what he says, you won't blast her into space. Oh, that's what he's saying. He says, you promise you won't blast her into space. And Max von Sydow's like, you know, gives him the eye. And he's like, well, until you grow weary of her.
And there is a lot of fun stuff like that. Like, you know, when she complains about how she just got engaged and now they're trying to kill her fiance. And
so in the middle of this marriage ceremony, Flash Gordon, you know, crashes into the building with the very TV show spaceship. And what I thought was great about it was the spike on the end of the spaceship goes through Max von Sydow. Right? So that's how
impales him.
Although, of course, we get the classic style of ending with this, right? Because he has his special ring, and when he dies, the ring falls off his finger. And then after everything else is done, we see somebody pick up the ring, and we kind of hear Max von Sydow's laugh. So, and it says the end, you know, with a question mark.
With a question mark. Yeah. I think the what was it, Son of Blob, whatever the sequel to The Blob was, they did the same thing in that, if I remember right.
And
and I've seen it in other movies too. The question mark.
There's an interesting behind the scenes stuff here because Sam Jones, who played Flash Gordon, and this was his first movie, and, you know, he was kind of picked out of nowhere as an actor, and he got into some fight with Dino De Laurentiis, and no one's quite sure what the fight was, but they took a holiday break, and then they fired him, and they actually dubbed a bunch of his lines. A different actor dubbed a bunch of his lines, and he is, I think, there's a documentary called Life After Flash, released just a few years ago, about making the movie and about him and what happened to him after that. And he regrets having been a jerk.
I did enjoy it. I'd watch it again. You know, I might wait a year or two, but I would eventually watch it again. And I'd say you have to go into it expecting that it's not going to be a serious movie. It is deliberately silly comic book movie with implausible coincidences, and you know, some of the green screen effects are not top drawer, and you know, so forth. If you go into it with the attitude of being willing to accept that level of campiness, I guess you'd say, then it should be quite enjoyable. And I did enjoy it. So, yes, that is a conditional worth watching.